Morning brings dawn, and dawn a new day. But what if this day was different? What if this day you could see beyond the surface of reality to the essence of creation? We'll come along on a journey to a place where the sun doesn't rise or set, where what you choose is what you get. It's a place that's all around you, but you haven't seen it yet. This is How the Universe Works with Michael Galileo.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to another edition of How the Universe Works with Michael Galileo. I am your happy-to-be-here host, Michael Galileo, and we're going to be talking about different aspects of the universe tonight, because, as Henry Miller says, the world is not to be put in order. The world is in order. It is for us to put ourselves in unison with that order. So, trying to find that order, that's what we're talking about here. Not even trying to find it. It has been found. It is all around us. It is just a matter of being able to see it. One need not seek truth only to cease to cherish opinion. And if we can get our opinions of how we think this world might work out of the way, we can actually see how the world does work. And that's what we're trying to talk about here. So we're going to talk about it in a few different ways tonight, kind of a potpourri type of a show. The scheduled theme for this evening is we're supposed to be talking about the work of Hugh Everett III, who you may or may not be familiar with. I wasn't until a few months ago when someone that I know brought his work to my attention. And we're going to talk about it tonight because, as we were talking about last week, the theme of last week's show was consilience. And consilience is a coming together of different disciplines of knowledge in a way that gives us insight into an underlying similarity, or shows us a truth, because we see things from different points of view. And that's what we're trying to do here with the show. Show lots of different points of view, talk about it from a lot of different angles, so that we can find the lowest common denominator that allows us to see exactly how it is that everything happens around here. And and the reason it's going to be a little bit of a potpourri is I want to go back to the consilience theme of last week before we bring Hugh Everett on board and start talking about his work and how it relates to the view of the universe that we talk about here, that possibility plus choice equals reality, and each moment becomes the next, and the fact that each moment becomes the next is the dynamic by which we can build bridges from where we are to where we'd like to be. And we do that all the time. It's not even something that we can choose to do if we like. If we decide to down the road, or if we choose to someday, that's exactly how we're building every day as we go along. And the question is, what possibilities are we choosing to get the outcomes that we are? And if we want different outcomes, which possibilities could we choose in order to create that? And that's kind of where Hugh Everett's work comes in the world of quantum mechanics and many worlds. And we'll talk about that. But the reason I wanted to get back to the consilience theory theme was because where I left it last week, I never actually got to the point where the word consilience came into being. I mean, we talk about what it means. We talked about that it was a unification of knowledge. We talked about an Ionian enchantment, you know, searching for an objective reality over revelation, and looking for something that is works together to explain all the aspects of both the physical and the scientific, and also the humanities and the spiritual aspect of our reality. So consilience, as I had mentioned, was a book by Edward O. Wilson, and this is where I first saw a blueprint for how it is that my view of the way that things come together to create this world came to being. It was because I looked at so many different places that the mathematics of my mind was able to find the lowest common denominator and spot the truth through it. And that is how is the best way to find the truth, through multiple points of view. I explained to people that finding truth is like guiding a boat into a harbor. You can't guide a boat into a harbor with just one buoy or one demarcation. You need two to line them up in order to know which side to stay on, where the channel is. If you're working with the green and the red buoys, the port and the starboards, that often mark channels, or even if you were working with buoys of the same color but were marking the channel, you would have to have at least two of them to know in what direction to head. So you would need at least two different points of view in order to know you were moving in the proper direction. And ideally, you would look for a minimum of three to really feel that there's a high probability of success if you were to follow those indications. And that's where consilience comes from. The more points of view that you have, the more information you're open to, the better your opportunity of finding the truth. And as we've determined, since we're making a decision and a choice in every moment, that is electromagnetically becoming the next moment, which is the dynamic by which all things are constructed around here, you're making a choice, and the choice that you're making is creating your reality. And the better the information you have regarding the choice that you're making, the higher your probability of success. So because each moment becomes the next, at a fixed rate here on Earth of about 18.5 miles a second for us human beings, it helps to be able to see the truth the more we make those decisions. So I just wanted to go back and do a little more reading out of the Consilience book, The Unity of Knowledge by Edward O. Wilson, get to the actual point at which the word consilience was coined, and then go a little bit further in Mr. Wilson's thoughts a little further on in the book, and that will, for all intents and purposes, lead us into the you Everett aspect of things. Tonight we're also going to have a musical message from Sam Phillips, and we have a new poem to share this evening about the universe. So we have lots of things. And what I'd like to do right now is I'll start with the Consilience book reading. Let's take this a little bit further. I'm not gonna read all the way through it, but the next chapter, which is where we get to the coining of the phrase, goes like this. From Edward O. Wilson, and this chapter is actually called The Great Branches of Learning. You will see at once why I believe that the Enlightenment thinkers of the 17th and 18th centuries got it mostly right the first time. The assumptions they made of a lawful material world, the intrinsic unity of knowledge, and the potential of indefinite human progress are the ones we still take most readily into our hearts, suffer without, and find maximally rewarding through intellectual advance. The greatest enterprise of the mind has always been and always will be the attempted linkage of the sciences and humanities. The ongoing fragmentation of knowledge and resulting chaos in philosophy are not reflections of the real world but artifacts of scholarship. The propositions of the original Enlightenment are increasingly favored by objective evidence, especially from the natural sciences. Consilience is the key to unification. I prefer this word over coherence because its rarity has preserved its precision, whereas coherence has several possible meanings, only one of which is consilience. William Whewell, in his 1840 synthesis, the philosophy of the inductive sciences, was the first to speak of consilience, literally a jumping together of knowledge by the linking of facts and fact-based theory across disciplines to create a common groundwork of explanation. He said, the consilience of inductions takes place when an induction obtained from one class of facts coincides with an induction obtained from another different class. This consilience is a test of the truth of the theory in which it occurs. The only way either to establish or to refute consilience is by methods developed in the natural sciences, not, I hasten to add, an effort led by scientists so frozen in mathematical abstraction, but rather one allegiant to the habits of thought that have worked so well in exploring the material universe. The belief in the possibility of consilience beyond science and across the great branches of learning is not yet science. It is a metaphysical worldview, and a minority one at that, shared by only a few scientists and philosophers. It cannot be proved with logic from first principles or grounded in any definitive set of empirical tests, at least not by any yet conceived. You see, and this is where I kind of take exception a little bit, because I believe that what we're doing here and what we see in every moment empirically tests this logic that we talk about here and shows how it indeed is the way that everything is created. Wilson goes on to say, its best support is no more than an extrapolation of the consistent past success of the natural sciences. Its surest test will be its effectiveness in the social sciences and humanities. The strongest appeal of consilience is in the prospect of intellectual adventure, and given even modest success, the value of understanding the human condition with a higher degree of certainty. But that's what we're doing here. We're taking a scientific principle, and we're showing how electromagnetically that equates to what the Bible talks about, and as ye sow shall ye reap, and where karma comes from, and where all the metaphysical symbolism comes from, all down to the bottom of the pattern that causes each moment to become the next in this universe. So this is what got my attention when I read this book, because when I read this book, I realized that some of the things that we're running into here, we actually have answers for at this point. So, which makes it very interesting. I have another quote here from the book that says, we already intuitively think of the four domains as closely connected. I don't want to get into that because that'll get a little too technical. But I want to skip ahead. So consilience there is where it came in. William Whewell in 1840, in the philosophy of inductive science, is the first to speak of consilience, literally a jumping together of knowledge. So, you know, that's why we're you know, actually a little ADD doesn't hurt you if you can focus that, because being able to see a variety of different things as opposed to the specialization that creates tunnel vision can allow one to comparatively and consiliently get a deeper understanding because of the variety of knowledge that one is considering. So there you go. A little further on, he in the book, and I came across this few paragraphs that I thought were pretty good to again lead us into the work of Whewell and parallel universes and quantum mechanics. Here, Wilson is suggesting that there is a way with enough knowledge from enough disciplines to be able to see beyond the surface, to be able to see what causes things to be the way they are, to be able to get to the base of it all. And then we can move into the concept of the possibilities and the quantum mechanics of that. And he continues on a little bit further on in the book with a little bit of a metaphor here. And I'm just going to read what he says. He says, with the aid of the scientific method, we have gained an encompassing view of the physical world far beyond the dreams of earlier generations. The great adventure is now beginning to turn inward towards ourselves. In the last several decades, the natural sciences have expanded to reach the borders of the social sciences and humanities. There, the principle of consilient explanation guiding the advance must undergo its severest test. The physical sciences have been relatively easy. The social sciences and humanities will be the ultimate challenge. The uncertain conjunction of the disciplines has mythic elements that would have pleased the ancient Greeks. Treacherous road, heroic journey, secret instructions that lead us home. The elements that have been assembled into many narratives over the centuries. Among them is the story of the Cretan labyrinth, which can also serve as a metaphor of consilience. And you're going to recognize in this a little bit of a musical message from a couple of shows ago by the band where we talked about where they sang Life is a Carnival, and they talked about the House of Mirrors, and we talked about the concept of reverse engineering and walking out of the House of Mirrors and out of the confusion into clarity. And this story goes like this. Into the heart of the Cretan labyrinth walks Theseus, Hercules-like champion of Athens. Through each corridor, past uncounted twists and turns, he unravels a ball of thread given him by Adrianne, love-struck daughter of Crete's king Minos. Somewhere in the hidden passages, he meets the Minotaur, a cannibal half-man, half-bull, to whom 7 youths and maidens are sacrificed each year as Athens' tribute to Crete. Theseus kills the Minotaur with his bare hands, then following Adrianne's thread, he retraces his steps through and out of the labyrinth. The labyrinth, its likely origin, a prehistoric conflict between Crete and Attica, is a fitting mythic image of the uncharted material world into which humanity was born and which it forever struggles to understand. It's that House of Mirrors. Consilience among the branches of learning is the Adrian's thread needed to traverse it. Theseus is humanity, the Minotaur our own dangerous irrationality. Near the entrance of the labyrinth of empirical knowledge is physics, comprising one gallery, then a few branching galleries that all searchers undertaking the journey must follow. In the deep interior is a nebula of pathways through the social sciences, humanities, art, and religion. If the thread of connecting causal explanation has been well weighed, it is nonetheless possible to follow any pathway quickly in reverse, back through the behavioral sciences to biology, chemistry, and finally physics. I'm going to read that sentence again because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about affecting behavior, affecting possibility through the quantum mechanics of how each moment becomes the next in the dynamic in this universe. And the sentence that Mr. Wilson says is, if the thread of connecting causal explanation has been well weighed, it is nonetheless possible to follow any pathway, quickly in reverse, back through the behavioral sciences to biology, chemistry, and finally physics. And that, again, is we can do the same thing with time. We can do the same thing moment by moment, and everything in this universe connects because everything follows exactly the same formula. It causes it to be exactly the way it is in every moment. And that's why you can go, you're always in the center of the circle, and you can always go from any point to anywhere else in the universe once you see what it is that Mr. Wilson is talking about here. He continues on. With time, we discover that the labyrinth has a troubling peculiarity that makes its complete mastery impossible. Aha. While there is an entrance, more or less, there is no center, only an immense number of endpoints deep within the maze. In tracking the thread backward, from effect to cause, assuming we have enough knowledge to do so, we can begin with only one endpoint. The labyrinth of the real world is thus a Borghesian maze of almost infinite possibility. We can never map it all. Never discover and explain everything. But we can hope to travel through the known parts swiftly, from the specific back to the general, and, in resonance with the human spirit, we can go on tracing pathways forever. We can connect threads into broadening webs of explanation because we have been given the torch and the ball of thread. There is another defining character of consilience. It is far easier to go backward through the branching corridors than to go forward. After segments of explanation have been laid one at a time, one level of organization to the next, to many endpoints, say geological formation of species of butterflies, that's what he's using here, but we could use choices within seconds in creating a reality, and it will apply just as well, and therefore hold up to what Mr. Wilson said earlier in the book about if it's well laid, this causal effect can be followed all the way through. But here he's using geological formations of species of butterflies. We can choose any thread and reasonably expect to follow it through the branching points of causation all the way back to the laws of physics. And you can take it all the way through to the edge of the universe. But the opposite journey, from physics to endpoints, is extremely problematic. That means from where you are to where you want to be. from what the possibility is to what it actually becomes. As the distance away from physics increases, the options allowed by the antecedent disciplines increase exponentially. Now, I'm going to stop there for a second, because you could compare that to the quantum mechanics of a hydrogen atom as determined by Niels Bohr. And when you see that, as we look at the simplicity of a hydrogen atom, it has only one electron, the probability of being able to determine where that electron is going to be and what the outcome is going to be is really not difficult, because there's only one electron. But then when we move up to helium, we have two electrons. And once we get two electrons moving around the proton, it becomes much more difficult to determine what's going to happen, because with those two interact with each other, there's a certain different possibilities will occur, and so on and so forth. And as the atoms get more complex and they have more and more electrons, what happens then is it gets harder and harder to determine the outcome, until something gets so volatile that you have like a uranium-238 completely volatile and unstable. And so you see, it's connecting all the way through here what we're talking about. And then, of course, we have that Fibonacci recurrent series of whole numbers, which we use to apply to those 18.5-mile-long seconds. And all of a sudden, you can plan and plot the choices that we make, not only our physical, the forensics of our physical existence, like in crime, you know, in crime shows, where we track everything back to the event that caused the crime, or science going back to the beginning of the universe, or anything. We can now do the same thing if we apply the dimension of distance to time, and we use the proportion system of time of years to do that with, and we break that down into individual seconds. We can basically put together an atomic structure for reality based upon our choices that is consistent with what it is that Mr. Wilson is talking about here in consilience, and trying to link the arts and humanities with physics. And that's what we're doing here. And I'm going to continue on. As the distance away from physics increases, the options allowed by the antecedent disciplines increase exponentially. It's harder to determine the further out you go. But, you know, when you get up in the morning, you put your feet out of the bed, you're already predicting the floor is going to be there if you're not looking down. So we at least go that far out with pretty good exactitude. Each branching point of causal explanation multiplies the forward-bound threads. Biology is almost unimaginably more complex than physics, and the arts equivalently more complex than biology. To stay on course all the way seems impossible, and worse, we cannot know before departure whether the complete journey we have imagined even exists. Right? Especially with us. It's all in our minds. It's all just possibilities. It's all just well, I think if I do this, this is probably going to happen, you know? And we make our choices to try to create it, and we see if it becomes real here in the physical world. So, you know, there's more on consilience. And that's going to lead us into what you, Everett, had to say from the scientific level about this. I'm going to try to work through that. We'll be back with after the break. We're going to take a break now, and we'll come back with a musical message from Sam Phillips, and then we'll talk about you, Everett the Third, and we will continue to consilently explain the universe in a way that we can all use. And that's what we're trying to do here. So I'll be back in a few minutes, and I'll talk to you then.
Buddha and all his successors talk about intellectual structures that confine us to an artificial environment and against concepts that smear over the living fact of things as themselves. So said Robert Aitken, a Zen Buddhist master. Now, with the real-time earth clock, you can pull back the veil of illusion that's helping to cloud truth in your environment. Traditional clocks unknowingly confuse our world with artificial interpretations of time, even going in the opposite direction from which time occurs. The real-time earth clock shows time as it actually happens, and in the process shows us the flow of life on planet Earth. The ultimate feng shui device. It's a totally natural way of looking at time. Want to see a bigger picture? Visit GalileoRealTime.com and click on Clocks. The real-time earth clock. It's time for a new perspective.
Did you know that you can rate this show on iTunes? The show you're listening to right now. It's true. You can leave your thoughts about the show, the topic, the guest. You can even leave a suggestion. Then, before you leave, rate the show. The hosts love hearing from you, so next time you download this show from iTunes, leave your thoughts and rate the show for the host and for others.
A wise man once said, "The world is not to be put in order. The world is in order. It is for us to put ourselves in unison with this order." Most would agree that's easier said than done. Well, getting in line with the universe is about to get a whole lot easier. Join host Michael Galileo Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Pacific Time and become empowered by the knowledge of how our universe works from one edge to the other. You didn't know there are edges? How about where time comes from? No? Wow! See? You do need this show. How the Universe Works with Michael Galileo, here on Contact Talk Radio.
Join Michael Galileo every Tuesday evening at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And for more information, check out his website at GalileoRealTime.com.
Fire burning underneath. I want
like finding a signpost in a strange land, which is not too far from what Mr. Wilson was talking about in the book Consilience before the break, about the labyrinth, and having to find that thread, and once you do, being able to move back and forth through the labyrinth with ease. And it's funny how those two completely different venues of, you know, of rock and roll type of a musical message, as opposed to a book written by a Harvard social biologist, Nobel Prize winner, I believe, that goes and uses Greek mythology, but we're all talking about the same thing. You know, it's we've been talking about it for thousands of years, the religion and science, and looking for it, trying to figure it out, and it's all around us, and we just have to be able to, you know, see it. So, and that's what we're trying to do here. I'm not trying to do, not trying to profess anything other than understanding how each moment becomes the next, seeing, having seen a pattern, seeing how it works, and trying to use all of the perspectives that are at my disposal to present this in a way that others can perhaps see it as well, because it is something that definitely can be seen, although the way we are brought up and educated, it makes it very difficult. You know, we're told words like sunrise and sunset, and I know they're great words, but they give an indication of something that's not true, and it begins to create a box of illusion, if you will, that causes us not to be able to see the world for all its possibility and all its potential, and instead are programmed into seeing things as objects as opposed to temporary states of conditions and circumstances that are always evolving, and it leads us into disappointment, and it leads us into confusion, and you know, we want to try to avoid that. We are looking for enlightenment. We are looking for a light to show us, you know, how it is that things work around here, and that's just it. Not trying to tell anybody what to do, but if everybody knows how it works, then everybody can handle it for themselves. You know, it's kind of like learning how to fish, so you can feed yourself. Kind of seeing how the universe works, so you can walk it by yourself, and you can make of it what you want. So, that's what we're trying to do. And before we get, you know, deeper into science with you, Everett, in physics, and we just came from Edward O. Wilson. I have a new little poem that I'm working on that I thought also, again, consiliently, come together to help us see something. And I guess I might be looking ahead to the coming season. It's probably the changing light because of our, you know, the seasonal change that's about to come about that we go through. It's perhaps had something to do with the timing of this, although the analogy that I make in this poem is something that I have thought of and used in descriptions many times, but it finally started to come out in a rhyme. So I'd like to read this to you, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. And the title of the poem is called Seconds Are Like Snowflakes. Yes, I'm thinking that far ahead. Seconds are like snowflakes. Ahead for where I am, maybe not where you are. Maybe there's snowflakes now. And the poem goes like this. Seconds are like snowflakes. No two are ever the same, even if they look alike and share from where they came. Each one is made of particles coming from thin air, and particles are different, and this one can't be there. Even if they're of the same source and composition, each one is different from the next, and they constantly transition. The landscape from the way it was to what it has become, as they pile up upon each other, one by one by one. And some of us make snowmen, and forts they will defend, and others spread their arms as wings, and hark, the heralds wend. The seconds are like snowflakes, they are at our command, to be constructed as we wish, like castles made of sand. But you can't make a snowman from flakes that are too dry, no matter how many that you see fall from the sky. No, the snowflakes have to be just right for them to stick together, and that depends, it is, you see, on the conditions of the weather. If the weather is just right, it all goes right together, and if it's not, just wait until the situation's better. Don't even bother trying to make a snowman when it's raining, unless it is its help you need in practice overstraining. You see, it's best to wait and watch the weather as it's changing, and plan ahead when things are right to do your rearranging. Of the snowflakes as they fall, like the passing of the seconds, into the dreams your snowstorm brings, as the drifting snowfall beckons. And that's what we're doing here. And each second is different than the one before and the one after. And I guess that's probably the biggest point I'm trying to make. And then the one after that and the one after that. And the fact that we're involved, we interface with the universe to create the reality by virtue of our choices out of what we believe possible. And that condition, that dynamic, that set of circumstances whereby each moment becomes the next comes from a wave of energy. It is a wave of energy that comes from the electromagnetic construct of this universe, this basically closed system universe, this universe that's shaped kind of like a soccer ball that we're in the middle of, approximately the middle of, not physically, but when I say not physically, I don't mean not materially, but in a state of perspective from the smallest thing in the universe to the largest thing in the universe, we're at approximately the middle of it, as we're working here, and each moment's becoming the next, and that particle wave that is created by the energy from the cosmic microwave background and the quasars and the stars that causes an ionization. It causes the base properties of this universe to ionize and polarize, and therefore begin to attract and repel and gather as matter in the areas that we have galaxies, things like that, where there are quasars and stars that cause matter to gather and cause it to be. So that's how everything is becoming. That's the dynamic, that constantly ongoing electromagnetic current causes everything to constantly attract and repel, that causes everything to constantly move from what it is to what it has to become, creates the system for our system of time, our proportion system of time, where man looks at a year, the amount of time that it takes for the Earth to go around the Sun, and then we break that down into days, weeks, and days, and minutes, and the smallest particle that really is usable is the second, and that second is 18 and a half miles long. And if you have a 72-year life expectancy when you're born, that means you have 2.25 billion seconds, and the universe gives them to us one at a time, coming from a big lake of potential. And the choice that we make in the current moment, or the now, that 18 and a half mile long second that you're in, and the possibility that exists within it from that which we choose, creates the subsequent moments and therefore the continuing reality. And it is up to us in every moment as to what it becomes, because nothing is here before the moment that it exists. Not the Earth, not the universe, not you, not anything is not here until the moment that it exists. And that's happening moment by moment. We're always pushing forward in that. There's no existing landscape that we walk on that's already there ahead of us. It's the electromagnetic current of the construct that is constantly vibrating and rearranging, if the electrical current were to go out, everything would disintegrate, like the conditions inside of a black hole, where there is no construct, because the power source that's required to cause the materials to ionize and polarize, you know, are out of the realm of being affected by that. So no thing exists in there because the material is not being constructed to be that. So, you know, that's what's going on. So each moment is becoming the next. So how does that relate to a fellow by the name of Hugh Everett III, who happens to be an American physicist? And what does his work have to do with that? What does his work have to say about that? Well, you know, I brought him up tonight because I think that, again, it's going to offer some deep-seated physics into what it is we're talking about, besides the light rock and roll and poetry and things that have been said. I will be completely honest with you, as I always am, in saying that I don't completely understand all of his work, but I do see a correlation between some of his concepts and what it is that we're talking about here. I am going to be reading from a few different sources about Hugh Everett to try to wrap our arms around what it is that he was trying to say and what it is that he was doing. So this is a little history on him. It says, Hugh Everett III was an American physicist who first proposed the many-worlds interpretation of quantum physics, which he called his relative state formulation. Relative state formulation. Sounds like circumstances and conditions. Discouraged by the scorn other physicists heaped on many-worlds interpretation, or MWI, Everett left physics after completing his PhD. Afterwards, he developed the use of generalized Lagrange multipliers in operations research and applied this commercially as a defense analyst and a consultant. He enjoyed commercial success for a while, although at the time of his death, he was facing financial ruin. Everett was born and raised in Washington, D.C. area. After World War II, his father was stationed in West Germany, and Hugh visited Leipzig in East Germany in 1949, graduated from the Catholic University of America in 1953 in chemical engineering, and then received a National Science Foundation fellowship that allowed him to attend Princeton. He started his studies at Princeton in the math department, working on the then new field of game theory, but slowly drifted into physics. In 1953, he started taking his first physics courses, notably Introductory Quantum Mechanics with Robert Dickey. For his second term at Princeton, starting in 1954, he moved into the physics department. His main course that year was Methods of Mathematical Physics with Eugene Wigner, although he stayed active in math, presented a paper on military game theory in December. He passed his general exam in the spring of 55, thereby gaining his master's degree, and he started work on his dissertation that would much later make him famous. He switched thesis advisors, blah, 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 blah. Okay. During March and April of 1959, Wheeler's Request, who was one of his teachers, right, his advisors, he visited Copenhagen on vacation with his wife and baby daughter in order to meet with Niels Bohr, the father of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. And the visit was a complete disaster. Everett was simply unable to communicate the core idea that the wave function should be regarded as a real classical field. This was simply hearsay to Bohr and others in Copenhagen. So, you know, he struggled with his ideas about parallel universes and many world interpretations. And the way that breaks down, I'm going to explain that a little bit now. We'll go into it. It says, it's a relative state formulation, theory of universal wave function, parallel universes, many universes interpretation, or just many worlds. It's all different ways of explaining it. Many worlds asserts the objective reality of the wave function, but denies the reality of wave function collapse. The subjective appearance of wave function collapse is explained by the mechanism of quantum decohedrons. See, this is really not getting me anywhere. I really apologize for that, because I had some good information on this that I really wanted to talk to you about. Because what I'm getting from this relative state formulation is that any state that you're in is relative, of course, to everything else around you. And therefore, the relativity of an individual, let's say your world, your particular world, is determined upon the choice that you make in every second. Now, the choice that you make creates the reality that you're in. And if we were to make a different choice, you would actually be creating a different reality. You would be creating a different world, a whole new way of going, a whole new set of experiences. And if this exists in the level of quantum mechanics and quantum physics, on that level, to explain the response and the behavior of particles within the universe, the behavior of any of those particles is no different than the behavior of one's relative world. In other words, the one that you're in every day, the one that you're choosing every day, that therefore becomes the reality that you're in, based upon the fact that each moment becomes the next, based upon the choice that we make in any moment. That's pretty much what we're talking about here. We have the power to be able to create, any world that we want. And the question is, what are we creating? Once we understand that each moment is becoming the next, and each second is 18 and a half miles long, then we have the ability to use that dynamic to create the reality to be any way that he wanted it to be. We want it to be, and it's up to us. And that's the way it works. So, being that I did say I was going to go through his work, I'm going to stick with that for the rest of the show. We have a few minutes left, I have a little bit more information here, of course. So, basically the key concepts are that 50 years ago, Euler devised the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, in which quantum effects spawn countless branches of the universe with different events occurring in each. So, again, my relation to that concept is that we are each doing the same thing every day in our world. If I read the next paragraph, the theory sounds like a bizarre hypothesis, but in fact Everett inferred it from the fundamental mathematics of quantum mechanics. Nevertheless, most physicists of the time dismissed it, and he had to abridge his PhD thesis on the topic to make it seem less controversial. Is it any less controversial for me to be saying that the next moment does not exist until it does, or that we choose our eventual reality? No ifs, ands, or buts, based upon the possibility that we believe possible, that there is no landscape for us to walk out on. It's all basically the same thing as Mr. Everett was talking about. So, that's really what we're talking about here. It says here, Everett's work is well known in physics and philosophical circles, but the tale of its discovery and the rest of his life is known by relatively few. Archival research by Russian historian Eugene So-and-so, myself and others, and interviews I conducted with the late scientist colleagues and friends, as well as with his rock musician son, unveil the story of a radiant intelligence exhausted, extinguished all too soon by personal demons. He had a lot of problems. Although it says Everett's revolutionary analysis broke apart a theoretical logjam in interpreting the how of quantum mechanics, Although the many worlds idea is by no means universally accepted even today, his methods in devising the theory presage the concept of quantum decoherence, a modern explanation of why the probabilistic weirdness of quantum mechanics revolves itself into the concrete world of our experience. And you know, we could, but you could make a direct correlation there to confusion. It's the quantum mechanics of our reality creating. And again, there's not everyone is accepting of this today, and that's why we're doing this show. You know, when you talk about quantum decoherence, that's nothing more than what we would consider to be chaos. And in our world, it appears that chaos is on the increase, when in actuality, that chaos is a symphony of well considered logical choices that create the chaos that it is, because they're well considered and they're logical, but if they're not based on the true principles on which the universe is operating, then the results are not going to be you know, what we expect them to be. So it all kind of wraps together, and I know it got a little convoluted here tonight with the Uevert thing. Tried to present some information, maybe a little bit of it, hopefully enough for you to go and if you're interested, and look a little bit deeper into what it was the man was talking about, the possibilities of parallel universes, of many worlds all existing simultaneously, and that's really what's going on here. The worlds that we dream of exist if we choose them to be, as opposed to the world that we do choose, unless we are choosing the world that we're dreaming, and then you've got this down. And if you have it down and you wonder why, and you weren't sure, well, rest assured, it's because the universe is creating the circumstances for each moment to become the next the way we choose it to be, and every new moment creates a new alternate universe, and we're creating it with our choices, and it's up to us, because we're self-aware and we have the power. So, you know, it's all about being able to see the possibilities, and each second is like a snowflake. They might look like they're just like the one before it and the one after it, but you know, they're a little bit different. And you know, it's up to us to be able to discern those differences in a way that we can you know, make the best choices, even though the you know, the possibilities don't necessarily look different. You know, it's the old, you know, how you doing today? Well, you know, same day, different stuff. But, I mean, same stuff, different day. And that's not the case. It's different stuff every second. And it's up to us to try to stay aware of that and not be mesmerized by the similarity and start taking moments for granted, because that's how they go past us and we miss potential and we miss possibilities. So it's all about staying aware. So on that note, I think we're going to wrap it up, give everybody's brain a chance to relax. I hope you enjoyed the poem. I hope you enjoyed Sam's song. We'll hear it again on the way out. Looking for a signpost, that's what we're trying to be here. Sometimes it's a little bit more confusing than other times, but don't give up. The more we listen to it, the more we'll get, the more we'll understand, and I appreciate you listening. So thanks again. This is Michael Galileo. I will see you all next week. In the meantime, have a good one. See you then.
How the Universe Works with Michael Galileo. If you have a question about anything that has been discussed on this show, feel free to drop us a line at contacttalkradio.com or visit www.galileorealtime.com. The views expressed by host Michael Galileo may not be that of this station, but they are certainly correct. Warning, the power generator.